The data have been convincing. Now there's an even greater effort to reduce the number of concussions. But do concussions affect genders differently?
What the study found is that there were higher levels in girls and women than there were in men with both baseline and after injury.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, how technology could be hampering rescue efforts at the Grand Canyon, the challenges of providing public health in rural Arizona, mapping for driverless cars in Tucson, and a new movie on the Gila River Indian community on a shoestring budget.
My brother and I, we didn't have any financial backing. We didn't have any real producers or production managers or anything, and no big stars to speak of.
Plus, the Valley's newest food critic and Arizona, ready for a new slogan. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. It's sunny right now, 104 degrees at 204. Lawyers for Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio said in court today they're trying to reach a settlement in the sheriff's contempt of court case. But as KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports, there are hurdles to reaching an agreement.
The sheriff and four members of his staff are facing contempt of court for violating the judge's orders in a racial profiling suit. The next round of contempt hearings begins September 22nd for 2 weeks. Those hearings would be canceled, though, if the two sides reach a settlement. Lawyers for the sheriff brought up that possibility to the judge on Friday. But there are challenges. For one, there isn't much time. Plaintiff's lawyer Cecilia Wong of the ACLU shares another.
The difficulty with reaching any settlement is that MCSO still has not produced the documents that they owe us, so we really can't assess what a proper remedy is.
That's been an ongoing point of conflict for the past several months. Plus,
there have been many revelations of documents that should have been, disclosed and were not.
Another example came to light this Friday after it came out that some deputies had been seizing many people's IDs and driver's licenses, seemingly without cause. The court gave the sheriff's office a February deadline to turn over copies of those IDs. But more and more hidden stashes of IDs keep turning up. Today, the sheriff's lawyers told the court the sheriff's office had just discovered more than 60 additional IDs. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Attorney Tom Ryan is preparing to file a complaint with the Arizona Attorney General's office in an attempt to remove Susan Bittersmith from the Arizona Corporation Commission. That could happen as early as next week. The complaint is centered on a potential conflict of interest with Bittersmith and her business ties. KJZZ's Christina Hansen broke the story this week and joins me with more on it. Hi, Christina.
Hi there.
So what is Ryan's argument?
Well, there's a few things he takes issue with. For one, Bittersmith runs a trade association for the cable industry, which is regulated at the federal and city levels. But some of her members, like Cox and Suddenlink, also provide landline phone services, and that's regulated by the Corporation Commission. The commission has approved things like tariff increases and removing bond requirements for Cox and Suddenlink since Bittersmith took office in 2013. And sometimes she's recused herself from those votes, and sometimes she hasn't. On top of that, Bittersmith has been a registered lobbyist for Cox for more than a decade. Tom Ryan argues that all of these things violate a conflict of interest law that's specifically for commissioners, and it actually removed another commissioner from office back in 1999. The law basically says that you can't even be elected to the commission if you're employed by or have an official relationship to a company that the commission regulates.
How did this fly under the radar for so long, and what does Bittersmith have to say about it?
Well, Bittersmith's always been open about her business connections, and everything I reported is public record and easily found online. So I just think no one really questioned her about anything until now. She says she doesn't have any conflicts, primarily because she says she works only with the cable side of these companies, which she says is totally separate from the telecom entities that she regulates at the commission.
And they do so because video providers are taxed differently than telephone providers, and it's a necessity of doing business to have two separate corporate entities.
But you've also done some more digging in this area since your story ran.
I have. So Cox uses this one specific entity for telecom issues before the commission, which is the one that Bittersmith says is totally separate from cable. But that same entity recently won a contract to provide telecom and internet services to the state. And in that contract, Cox identifies the parent company of that entity which also happens to be the same company that Cox uses for cable agreements with cities.
So what does Bittersmith say about that, and what do other people who have knowledge about this kind of thing have to say about that?
Well, I sent her the contract itself, and she just said that she had no knowledge of the contract itself, so she wasn't able to answer any of my questions. I spoke to Pat Quinn, who is the former director of RUCO, and he's also a former president of Qwest Communications. And he says cable companies do keep telecom separate from an accounting standpoint because it's regulated differently. But he says the Cox contract that I found shows that's where the separateness really ends.
The way they're doing business, the fact that they're going together to get clients, the way they're marketing things, they're not fully separate.
Ultimately, though, interpreting these kinds of technicalities from a legal standpoint will be up to the Attorney General or the courts.
KGZZ's business correspondent, Christina Hansen. Christina, thanks.
Thanks, Mark.
New research on concussions shows they seem to affect men and women about the same, but in the study, women had more symptoms in baseline testing before suffering a concussion. To explain what that means, we turn to Dr. Javier Cardenas, director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute and director of the Barrow Concussion Network.
What the study found is that overall, females have a higher concussion symptom baseline, if you will, and then they also have higher values after an injury. Now, when they're talking about symptom baselines, we're talking about physical symptoms, behavioral symptoms, and cognitive symptoms when we're looking at these things. So what the study found is that there were higher levels in girls and women than there were in men with both baseline and after injury. Although looking across the board, and there was another study that looked at a number of these studies, a meta-analysis of these studies, and found that while there were raw differences, the statistical difference wasn't that great.
Do we have a sense for why there would have been even any kind of difference?
Yes. So when it comes down to some of the risk factors for concussion, taking gender out of the picture, what you're looking at is you're looking at those factors that might be evidence that they're going to take longer to recover. So, for example, people who have a history of migraines are at greater risk for having a longer concussion recovery. People who have a history of anxiety or depression are also at risk for having a longer recovery. And then finally, when it comes to learning disabilities or attentional deficits, they have a longer risk of recovery. Now, in females, there are also a higher rates of migraine headaches, especially in the adolescent population. And so some of those numbers are likely accounted for that. So when it comes to risk of concussion differences between men and women, there is data to suggest that neck strength plays a big role. So, for example, the neck strength of females is not as strong as that of males. And that's why we actually see a difference in the rates of concussion in female soccer and female basketball compared to their male counterparts. So in that area, we actually see differences in the incidence of concussion based on gender.
With all of the attention that has been placed on concussions and concussion prevention over the past few years, have we seen a decrease in the number of concussions, especially among athletes?
We've seen a significant decrease in the NFL numbers. And the reason for that is that they're looking and they have a captive population where you can get a lot of data and it's pretty reliable. The other is that they've instituted a number of rules that have decreased the incidence of concussion, including helmet-to-helmet hits. What we're seeing elsewhere actually is an uptick in the amount of concussion, especially in high school and youth sports. And the biggest part of that is because of awareness and education, which we want to see an initial uptick. We want to implement changes, including policy, which we've done here in Arizona, and then see a subsequent decrease in the incidence.
Is that an indication, maybe not that more kids are getting concussions, but that more of them who have been getting them are being diagnosed?
That they're being diagnosed, that they are presenting to healthcare providers. Many of them historically would simply go home, and then they would recover at home without presenting themselves to a healthcare provider.
So at what point do you hope to see the decrease?
I think within the next 2 to 3 years, we should see a substantial decrease, especially as more states adopt reductions in contact activity. And so what you'll see is you'll see that decrease in the amount of concussion.
Dr. Javier Cardenas is the director of the Barrow Concussion and Brain Injury Center at Barrow Neurological Institute and the director of the Barrow Concussion Network. This week's ruling by a Maricopa County Superior Court judge that the assessment used to pay for part of Arizona's Medicaid expansion is constitutional has set the stage for an appeal to the State Court of Appeals. It also brought at least temporary sighs of relief from expansion supporters, including Dan Dirksen. He's director of the Center for Rural Health at the University of Arizona and says small towns face big health care challenges.
Number one, there's fewer health providers. There's often health profession shortages in rural areas. The population that lives and works in rural areas tends to have a higher percentage of people without health insurance, higher rates of poverty, fewer jobs. So those are some of the challenges. Arizona is fortunate in that it has a very strong provider community, even in the rural areas. But because of the other issues I mentioned, they often face budget shortfalls because of the high uncompensated care rate that they might do and difficulty recruiting and retaining health providers, nurses, physician assistants, physicians, dentists who will work in those communities for the long term.
Does all of that make preventative treatment really, really hard?
I think that one of the challenges that we have to address in Arizona is access to primary and preventive services. Probably of the shortages in healthcare infrastructure in rural areas, those are the major ones. And if you have a good, vibrant, robust primary and preventive services infrastructure in a community, you can prevent hospitalizations. You can treat illnesses and diseases at earlier stages and prevent costly admissions for things that could have been dealt with a strong primary care system. We do have shortages of certain specialties and access to specialty services. Certainly general surgery is one of the ones that was very helpful for the health of a rural healthcare infrastructure. And then the network, so if someone is seen in one of these private clinics or federally qualified health centers or rural health clinics, when they need a higher level of service, let's say there's a suspicious mammogram and they need to see someone to get a biopsy of a lump or something like that. Those communities that have a very strong relationship with a tertiary care or urban hospital, those folks get in sooner and they get treated sooner and things like that. So right now, a lot of the communities are really trying to broaden the scope of services that they can offer in partnership with more urban tertiary care hospitals that can manage those things that require referral.
Is there a concern that in smaller communities, if somebody has an ailment that maybe is slightly more stigmatized, something like an STD, for example, that they might be less willing to try to get it diagnosed or get treatment for because they're concerned that it's a small town, people are going to find out, and they're going to look at this person differently?
Well, I think that the privacy of health information, there's very good regulations and policies in place to make sure that patient privacy is protected. I think there's some concern, you know, when you have a separate type of thing of, let's say, a alcohol or drug treatment program or a behavioral health or mental health programs, when those are incorporated in a seamless way in, let's say, one of these clinics or affiliated with one of the medical access or rural hospitals in the state, people are coming in, there's a full array of services. That also helps protect the privacy of information.
Dan Dirksen is director of the Center for Rural Health at the University of Arizona. Dan, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Hiking into the Grand Canyon this time of year is popular but dangerous, as remote areas and high temperatures can make search and rescue efforts difficult. First responders are further hampered by old technology, slowing down rescue efforts. From the KJZZ Science Desk, Andrew Bernier reports.
Summer temperatures and increased visitors can put a strain on personnel and resources used for search and rescue missions. The park has seen a 25% increase in visitors and an additional 250,000 more cars since January. CJ Malcolm is a ranger paramedic and the Preventative Search and Rescue, or PSAR, supervisor.
It was something like 110 degrees down in the canyon, and we got slammed yesterday. A few days before that, it wasn't so hot and we weren't slammed. So the strongest relationship between search and rescue events and calls for assistance is weather.
While digital radios are the current lifeline of immediate communication between first responders and emergency services on the rim, they still have limitations.
Right now with our current radios, 30% of the transmissions are not going through, and that's a big deal when you're in emergency services.
This prompted nonprofit partner Grand Canyon Association, or GCA, to try and replace some of the dated technology. Helen Ranney with GCA says they are trying to raise over $100,000 for things like new radios and electronic preventative signage.
The public now are very in tune to electronic devices, and they go right by some of those printed warning signs that are there on the bulletin boards.
Electronic bulletin boards can show real-time data in multiple languages, since 40% of the park's visitors are international. Communication technology has come a long way at the canyon. Ken Phillips has been in search and rescue for over 30 years. He says his early days were not easy.
We'd fly off in the helicopter, and as we descend out into a remote section of Grand Canyon, we would basically say goodbye on the radio. You're going to the dark side of the moon, and that's really not the way to do business as an emergency responder.
The Grand Canyon is a remote wilderness with many peaks, valleys, and ridges. It eats up and blocks radio signals. Phillips says some communication technology has improved at the canyon, though mostly well above it.
Park-wide radio system only reaches a small percentage of the backcountry, and having satellite phones is a critical communication tool for emergency responders. They can reach the hospital and be in direct contact with a physician.
But canyon infrastructure is still dated. Telephone lines in canyon are older than lines coming from outside the park. These lines, which canyon weather and medical stations are linked to, fail often. This October, Malcolm is looking to collect data on possible line-of-sight digital transmission, testing popular points on and in the canyon.
If that's a successful test, we're going to beef that up to see if we can get voice and data. So we can now use a wireless signal, which makes perfect sense. It's only maybe a mile and a half line of sight down to these stations to get voice connection and data connection and our weather stations connected.
Malcolm says it would send files to medical stations at busy parts of the trail and get reliable data from weather stations measuring the microclimates in the canyon. Still, radios are the primary means of communication. Brandon Torres is chief of emergency services at Grand Canyon.
What is the most frequent question that we ask each other on the radio? Where are you at?
Torres refers to radio towers on the rim as repeaters. With a few around busy trails, they relay signals from rangers and PSAR staff. While invaluable, Torres says they don't want too many.
We don't want a repeater every 5 miles to gain 100% coverage of the Grand Canyon, because we'd be defeating our wilderness mission.
There are about 300 search and rescues a year and up to 600 hiker assists on the main trails. That work falls on the small staff of PSAR volunteers and rangers who are in charge of an area slightly larger than Delaware. They focus most of their effort on actively profiling visitors, checking gear, facial expressions, water, and location. And if something seems out of place, they'll stop and talk to you. Ranney says this has been the biggest help in light of technology shortcomings.
The PSAR program helps protect the lives of the visitors, helps protect the Grand Canyon itself, but also protect our Park Service staff who put their lives on the line every day when they're in the canyon because of stupid people like us who take on something that we should not have done.
And if more visitors can be reached and prepared before entering the canyon, it may save lives without needing to radio in for a helicopter. At the Grand Canyon, I'm Andrew Bernier, KJZZ News.
Coming up, listeners offer some creative ideas for Arizona's new branding campaign.
Arizona, armed and dangerous.
That and more just ahead. It's the show. Hello, this is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Quick check of valley traffic. I-17 southbound, the exit ramp at Bethany Home is restricted. Elsewhere, accidents 51 northbound at the 101 Pima Freeway connecting. It's on the exit ramp there. Also on the 101 southbound in the East Valley at Broadway. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon. Very slight chance for showers with a high of 109 today. 108 was our high yesterday. 104 is average. Partly cloudy tonight. Still a slight chance for rain. Overnight lows in the mid to upper 80s. Partly sunny skies for the weekend. Still a slight chance of showers. About a 10% chance both tomorrow and Sunday. Look for a high of 110 tomorrow. We're cooling all the way down to 106 on Sunday. Right now in Phoenix, it's 104 degrees at 224.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, unveiling the 2015 XV Crosstrek, a 34 mpg compact utility vehicle for that go-anywhere spirit. Shop Subaru.com.
This is KJZZ. You're listening to The Show, a curated hour of local, national, and international news. I'm Mark Brody, along with the takeaways, Todd Zwillick today.
This preview has been approved for all public radio audiences.
Nuclear secrets, official government cables, Hillary Clinton's emails. The idea of someone stealing these fill our blood with terror. But now, other nations are after something much more dangerous. Something that could bring down America as we know it. This time, our enemies go straight for the heartland.
Corn!
When China's spies go after our unguarded corn seeds, who will fight back?
I'm not making this up.
Only federal agents can protect our nation's most desired crop, but can they stop China from stealing our corn?
You're sure it's not just
a
bad dream?
It was a mission. And I was there.
The Corn Identity. Coming soon, or now.
You know, sometimes a real-life story can sound way too much like a cloak and dagger spy movie. But there have been a number of recent cases that have found Chinese agriculture executives guilty of trying to steal seeds from the test fields of U.S. agribusiness, giants like Monsanto and DuPont, including a guy named Mo Hailong. He was caught stealing from some Iowa cornfields in 2011, and the FBI says that he was involved in a scheme to steal U.S. biotech in order to produce American-quality corn crops in China. Ted Genoways is a contributing editor for The New Republic and an agriculture journalist, and he says that this is serious business because 94% of the corn that China imports is coming from the United States, and the Chinese are desperately trying to close that gap.
To start with, there's a situation where the middle class in China has been burgeoning. And one of the things that goes along with that is that there's an increased demand for luxury food items, most notably meat. Particularly in China, there's an interest in and an appetite for pork. And all of the pork that is being raised in China is being fed on corn. And so this means that there's a huge increase in the demand for feed corn. China doesn't have domestic production to come anywhere close to meeting that climbing need. So what they've been doing is importing American corn, and whenever they have a shortfall, they have to turn to the U.S. to cover that gap. So it really is a situation where they are totally dependent on us for this commodity.
And that's where theft comes into play, right? Now explain what Mo Hailong was doing here.
Yeah, so the FBI's case is that they had reports that Mo had been found by farmers who were raising test seeds for Monsanto and for DuPont Pioneer in their fields. And in one circumstance, that was observed actually digging corn seeds out of the ground in order to just simply steal them right after they had been planted. And the reason for that is that those seeds contain really two vital pieces of information for a company like the one that Mo was heading up. And there's information that's contained there about the hybrid and the seed stock that is the seed itself. There's also the transgenes, the genes that have been inserted into genetically modified corn seed in order to make that corn express certain characteristics. And it appears that what Mo was doing was stealing seeds and then planting them at his own test plot that he had established secretly in Illinois in order to see what those seeds were capable of doing. And then the seeds that were producing the kind of crop that he wanted, he was attempting to smuggle out of the United States and back to China.
But this went to another level, Ted, because you're reporting that the government actually resorted to the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, when they were tracking Mo. And I know a little bit about the FISA court. That's for terrorism and bombs going off and NSA surveillance, not for stealing corn.
That's right. So this is something new. It's a new development and a new usage of FISA. The language of FISA itself specifically says that this is an attack, sabotage, terrorism, or clandestine intelligence activities. So the bar is incredibly high, but clearly what happened here was that the FBI was making the case before the FISA court that there was enough value in these corn seeds to the American food supply and to our dominance of the world's food supply, that this was something that was a matter of national security.
Well, is it a matter of a company like Monsanto or DuPont with all of their power, you know, having enough clout to get the FBI to really go hard at their enemies? Or is that an example of the Obama administration sending a message to China? We're putting this up on the same pedestal as terrorism.
Well, I think it's a bit of each, and I think that it's very difficult, actually, historically, to separate the U.S. government's goals from the goals that they've established with some of these companies. I think it's important to remember that companies like DuPont and Monsanto started as defense contractors, and so it's not unusual to me that their corporate culture is to think of their products as matters of national security and as products that they are primarily aiming toward the U.S. government. And I think it's also not too surprising that the U.S. government sees those companies in the same light. What's changed is that rather than being part of the Department of Defense, they've moved over to the Department of Agriculture and are really trying to use American agriculture as a similar tool, and the USDA itself at various times has said even as a weapon in international relations. Going back to the Nixon administration, corn in particular has been used by the USDA as a food weapon against the Russians and against the Chinese.
Ted Genoways is an agriculture journalist and contributing editor at The New Republic. Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick.
Earlier this month, Governor Doug Ducey announced the state would develop a new branding campaign to encourage tourism and economic development. We asked KJZZ listeners to write to us with their suggestions for a new state slogan, and doing our part, we put together a sampling of your best contributions for the state's consideration.
Arizona, it's a dry heat.
Arizona, Canada's newest province.
Arizona, the better sunshine state.
Arizona, armed and dangerous.
Only in Arizona.
Arizona, the anti-California.
Arizona, if we can put up with Sheriff Joe for this long, we can put up with you too.
Arizona isn't the first to attempt to polish its image with new branding. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins found out that a lot of states use marketing to try and boost their image.
That's right, Mark. South Dakota recently produced a viral sensation with a new tongue-in-cheek ad aimed at promoting what was previously known as the Mount Rushmore State.
South Dakota, progressive, productive, and abundant in oxygen. Why die on Mars when you can live in South Dakota? South Dakota, you can live here.
I talked with Pat Costello. He's the commissioner of the Governor's Office for Economic Development in South Dakota, and he told me this was the first of a series of lighthearted ads that will be tied to current news events like Mars exploration in an attempt to kind of get people's attention. He says his state's biggest issue is getting people to move there to fill a growing need for employment.
We took on an effort to initiate a workforce recruitment effort, and so we did focus groups across the Midwest and went out and visited with them and wanted to learn more about ourselves, what their perceptions were, what they thought of the state, that kind of stuff.
So what was some of the feedback?
One of the things that is very similar to when we recruit businesses is that businesses just aren't thinking of South Dakota when they're thinking about growing or expanding or moving their or looking for a new environment. Same thing with people. If a man or woman in another state decides for whatever reason that they want a shift in environment, they want something different, they want a different career path, and they're thinking about where else can I go besides where I'm at right now to meet my needs, they're just not inherently thinking about South Dakota. So what we learned from that is that if we want to grow our workforce and recruit people to the state, we're going to have to go get them. And so that's what this branding campaign is about. It's about workforce recruitment.
The ad campaign, can you talk a little bit about what is the perceived value of having kind of like a slogan to bring people in? And then specifically this ad that received a lot of attention about, you know, why dying on Mars when you can move to South Dakota.
Our ad campaign is all focused around our website and driving traffic to our website and getting people to look on it, to see the quality of life, to see the jobs that are available, and to get a little bit better understanding of what South Dakota is about. We have very limited dollars, and so we chose that we wanted to go with more of a digital approach, although we have some traditional media mixed in there. But it's largely a digital approach. And when we're looking for, when you're thinking about that digital, we want to make sure that we grab people's attention. So the first thing is we got to get their attention, and then once we got their attention, we want to get them to our website. So that's the Mars thing is just the first volley of this. Is this is a 3-year campaign for us, but we've just seen tremendous success from it. I think we're laughing with ourselves, and we understand that. Some people are laughing at us. I assume that's the case, but it's been very effective for us.
Well, Commissioner, thank you for your time and for telling us about the state of South Dakota.
You bet.
And Mark, the state of Arizona is still accepting ideas for our campaign. We'll link to the address for submissions at theshow.kjzz.org.
That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thanks.
My pleasure, Mark.
Still to come, mapping simulations to test driverless cars in Tucson.
You have lots of pedestrians, you have lots of bikes on the road, and so it's a good sort of all-around simulation, if you will, for what American cities are going to look like in the future.
That future, at least for this story, is just ahead. It's the show. In Valley traffic, 202 eastbound Red Mountain Freeway, an accident at Country Club Drive has the right lane blocked. 101 southbound at Broadway, an accident blocks the shoulder. And on the 101 southbound in the West Valley at Union Hills Drive, there's a report of fallen trees on the freeway, so be careful in that area. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 109, up to 110 tomorrow, 106 on Sunday. Right now, under sunny skies, 104 degrees at KJZZ at 236.
KJZZ is supported by El Charro, Paradise Valley's historic destination dining experience. You can enjoy cocktails, seasonal cuisine, and patio views of Camelback Mountain. Details at elchorro.com.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. Earlier this week, Uber announced it'd be working with the University of Arizona on mapping technology as the company continues its research into driverless cars. So what does that mean, and how soon could the car next to you on the freeway be autonomous? For those answers, we turn to Jonathan Sprinkle, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the U of A.
One of the things that everyone in the business of autonomy has to do is have a way to test. And we see this in airlines and pilots, that they spend a lot of time training in simulators. And the approach that Uber and everybody else in the industry is taking is trying to build very realistic simulators so that they can check to make sure that the systems that they're deploying are going to be safe.
And these are theoretically meant to simulate what driving on a surface street would be like, or a freeway or something like that?
Yes, sir. So you can think of them a little bit like a really sophisticated video game. except instead of being behind the controller, you're actually using simulated sensors to detect where the road is, where other cars might be, where are there trees up there, power lines, stop signs, these kinds of things. And so one of the approaches that almost everyone is taking is trying to build the most realistic three-dimensional world simulator that they can so that they can check to see what happens if one of my sensors goes bad or if somebody walks out in front of me.
How much does the location in which the mapping has happened end up playing a role in this, you know, virtual reality that's being created?
I would say that no matter where you're going to be deploying these vehicles, you're going to need fairly accurate maps before you deploy the vehicles there. And so Southern Arizona is a great place to begin with because we have so much sunshine and also because our streets are really straight and have lots of right angles. And so if you wanted to pick a place to begin, this is a pretty nice place to begin. But I think that, you know, whoever is in the business is going to eventually start moving to other locations and doing more kinds of maps where maybe they cannot depend on always having good weather or always having straight roads.
Places where maybe the terrain's a little more complicated, the roads aren't quite as much in a grid like they are in Tucson.
Exactly.
Is it possible to build simulations to factor in every potential thing that one could come across while you're driving? I mean, there's so many variables when you're behind the wheel. I mean, I can only imagine how much time and effort it would take to try to simulate every single one of those.
You've identified one of the key limitations to using simulation as a proof that something is safe. So even now, when we talk about pilots training in simulators, they're training in situations in which something bad may have happened before. And once that really bad thing happens, they make a list of all the stuff that happened, put it in simulation, and train people on that kind of scenario for the future. So simulation always has its limitations because there could be something that you never dreamed up that actually goes wrong. And that's, again, sort of an interesting case for autonomy. How much simulation are we willing to accept to say, well, it's probably pretty close to being safe enough? Realistically, the simulation is the first step, and you'd like to apply more sophisticated methods later to something called verification, where you actually confirm that no matter what happens, we're still going to behave safely.
How close are researchers to having some kind of mapping process done where these autonomous cars can be tested on actual roads?
I would say that they're really close. I would expect in the next year or two to start to see more and more vehicle manufacturers being able to tout the self, you know, the hands-free driving and congested traffic, or hands-free driving and stop-and-go traffic, or hands-free driving on the highway. I think that these things are creeping in now, and in large part, they're creeping in kinds of scenarios where they know they can depend on the sensors that they currently have.
Given what you said about why Tucson is a good place to start this kind of mapping technology, would it also stand to reason that Tucson, a place like Tucson, if not the city itself, would be a good place to start testing these vehicles once they're ready to go?
Yeah, I definitely think so. And we saw in several past kinds of technology that I think Tucson was a place where Nissan decided to deploy their Leaf for initial testing to see whether it was going to work in this kind of a market. You know, it's a fairly progressive city in terms of what kind of lifestyles people lead. And so you have lots of pedestrians, you have lots of bikes on the road. And so it's a good sort of all-around simulation, if you will, for what American cities are going to look like in the future.
Jonathan Sprinkle is a professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Arizona.
Earlier this year, longtime Arizona Republic dining critic Howie Seftel put away his knife and fork and expense reports. After a lengthy search, the paper found his successor, Dominic Armato, the founder of PhoenixFoodNerds.com. Dominic, are you going to approach reviews differently than what people have expected from a traditional critic?
I don't know that it's any different in terms of how I approach it. I mean, you know, what matters is the food and the service in the room and you know, the experience. I mean, there's a whole experience there, and I don't think that changes at all. I mean, I think, you know, obviously the fact that it's a non-anonymous role now and that you know, I'm going to be out there talking with readers and talking with chefs and doing events and writing other pieces that are not just reviews. You know, it broadens the scope outside of the review context, but I think the reviews themselves, you know, that's sort of that's its own little box. You know, it's one thing. It's, you know, I want to get in there and talk to people. Hey, tell me about this dish. What makes this so cool? I want to learn from you guys. And then, you know, then it's sort of like, now it's review time.
You mentioned the anonymity part going away. And some people are really concerned about that because they feel like you're going to get treated better than the average person because they're going to say, oh, well, I know Dominic. I've seen his face before. Let's give him a little extra kick that maybe the other person wouldn't get. Why shouldn't people be concerned about that?
I think they should be concerned about it. There's nothing wrong with being concerned about that. I think it's a totally reasonable concern. And when they say that, you know, I will probably be treated differently, they're probably correct, you know. And it's not, I don't think of it so much, you know, this isn't an attack on traditional anonymous restaurant criticism. I'm a big fan of that. And I believe in anonymity as an Olympian ideal. But it's really hard to do nowadays, you know, and you know, a couple things. I mean, one of the things is that I kind of feel like this anonymous or non-anonymous debate, and it's a good one, is kind of predicated on the notion that anonymous reviews are actually anonymous, which a lot of times is not the case. You know, I mean, all it takes today, and you hear the stories that get out into the press, you know, about how someone takes a little smartphone picture and, you know, these chefs know each other and they pass it around. Next thing you know, half the town's got the critic's photo. I'm sympathetic to that concern, and it's a real concern. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's one that can be addressed both by being aware of what's going on. I mean, you know, to anyone who's paying attention, you can tell if one table's getting a whole lot more attention than the rest of the room. But beyond that, it's like, you know what? There are a lot of reviews that you've read that were, in theory, anonymous reviews that weren't, you know, because it's in the restaurant's best interest to keep that quiet if they know a critic's in the house. So, you know, there's a trade-off. You know, it's a trade-off. You are giving up something. I don't want to diminish that. But mm-hmm. at the same time, you know, you're gaining the ability to do other things as well. And I think it's a good trade-off. And, you know, I think it makes it for not a better role, but just a different role. And I'm excited to explore that a little bit because this is kind of new, you know. I mean, there are some critics who are just kind of dropping anonymity and then it's business as usual, you know. But we're really kind of approaching this from the start as a very different sort of role. And, you know, and I hope we get the chance to really explore that and do some cool things and see what works and what doesn't. And we'll adjust as we go.
Are you going to be able to kind of stay diverse in terms of the neighborhoods you cover?
It's a difficult thing because I know sometimes people get frustrated because they feel like dining coverage is so centered on, you know, Old Town Scottsdale and Arcadia and to a lesser extent downtown, you know. And you know, to a certain extent, that's inescapable because so many high profile restaurants open there. But, you know, I mean, what gets me so jazzed is trying to just drive around and walk into, you know, 40 different restaurants in one day and take a peek at all the menus and try to find something different and interesting. And I love digging like that. That's always been something that excites me. So I, you know, I want to get all around town and I want to try to find as much as possible outside of that context. And like one of the things that makes me so excited right now, there's almost like this little mini revolution that's kind of just starting to get going, and I hope it catches on, you know, with Little Miss Barbecue and Welcome Chicken and Donuts and Noble Eatery. You know, there are these little places now that are starting to buck the conventional wisdom that, hey, if you're a high profile chef, oh, you've got to, you know, you've got to have a big build out and you've got to be in Old Town Scottsdale and you got to have plenty of parking and it's got to be this big, beautiful room and you have to have a big menu for everybody. And that's not the case. You know, I mean, these places are showing, you know what, you can just do a couple of things and do them really, really, really well.
Is there a concern that, like, some places you just really don't want to have to go back to the third time, but you have to do the review?
Absolutely. I mean, that is, you know, it's funny because there's sort of this, I think there's this perception that, oh, it's great, you get to go out and eat all the time. How much fun is that? And it's like, yeah, it's great, except when you have to keep going back to places that you don't like at all. And it's like after a second or a third time, it's like, it's hard not to take it personally sometimes, you know? It's like, oh, come on, you guys. I just, you know, can we get this right? It gets frustrating. And, you know, eating can be work. You know, I just published a piece about, you know, 20 BLTs around town. And like, you know, on BLT 2 or 3, it's like, this is great. By the time you get to BLT 17 or 18, it's like, just kill me now, please. I'm done with BLTs.
Dominic Armato is the new dining critic for the Arizona Republic and AZ Central. Dominic, great to meet you. Thanks for
Likewise.
Coming
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. In Valley traffic, 202 eastbound Red Mountain Freeway at Country Club Drive, an accident blocks the shoulder. Likewise on the 101 southbound at Broadway. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 109. Partly cloudy tonight, slight chance of storms, overnight lows in the mid-80s. and a sunny weekend with a slight chance of rain. High of 110 tomorrow, 106 on Sunday. It's 104 degrees at KJZZ at 250. A young man leaves Phoenix and moves back to the Gila River Reservation. Once he gets there, he tries to reconnect with old friends, but gets caught up with a tough crowd.
What are you gonna do now anyways, one big party?
You're supposed to be one of the biggest riders out here. You know what's marketing in circles?
It's good to have you back and all, but are you really gonna start hanging out with those little graffiti friends of yours?
That's the premise of the movie In Circles, which was co-directed and co-written by brothers Claude and Robert Jackson. Both are members of the Gila River Indian community, and both have day jobs that do not involve film. The brothers grew up in South Phoenix, and I asked Claude how much the movie drew on those experiences.
In South Phoenix, I mean, there was the element of gangs, there was neighborhood, there was some people that we've run into that just had like a hopelessness to them. But we also, I mean, we're college educated ourselves, and we also knew about the strength in families, the strength in somebody trying to pick themselves up and move beyond the danger and the violence around.
Is this a common story of tribal members leaving the reservation for whatever reason and then coming back?
No, I wouldn't say it's that common of a story. It does happen. That part of our story wasn't really to that effect. Ours was just about someone that just didn't make it. And it wasn't necessarily a failure. It was just something wanting to come back home.
Robert, what do you hope that people who see this movie take out of it? What's the message you're trying to get across here?
Well, there's two things. One of them is that we want to, me and my brother, stand on our own as artists, as filmmakers. And so we want to be respected and appreciated for the movie that we did. And the second thing is the way we went about it is because my brother and I, we didn't have any financial backing. We didn't have any real like producers or production managers or anything, and no big stars to speak of. The vast majority of the people that worked on our film in front of the camera and behind the camera, they're amateurs. We want people to understand that, you know, the community, it's a place where there's stories like this that could happen anywhere. And so we just want to open up that side of what Gila River is about the young people out there really trying to make a difference.
It sounds like it's kind of a story about community both on the screen and in the making of the movie.
Yeah, that's definitely true because, you know, my brother and I, we're always been film fans, and it's just a difficult industry to try to break into if you really don't have connections or you're not in Hollywood or whatever the case is. But, yeah, the community really rallied around our project, and, you know, we became a tight-knit group over the course of our production, and it's really helped us, you know, in the community as well because they see us doing positive things.
We spent roughly maybe $2,000 to make the movie.
Wow.
And yes, and the reason we were able to do that is because the community itself provided us with the use of some film equipment. And so we were able to offset that cost, of course. And the community obviously let us shoot within the community, within any of the businesses there, some buildings, some government buildings there. So it was a wonderful opportunity. They supported us wholeheartedly. We didn't want to go to them and ask for money. If we knew we could do it, then we just did it.
Is there something gratifying about producing a film about basically your community, about the people that you grew up with, the people who are your neighbors?
That's definitely a gratifying thing because what me and my brother did, as far as I know, we're the only ones to ever do something quite like this. Now, there are filmmakers in our community and you know, there's a lot of people that are real savvy with cameras and different kinds of equipment. But what me and my brother accomplished, you know, we share with everybody in Gila River and hopefully with the rest of everybody in Phoenix and, you know, worldwide. So bringing the reservation, this side of things, to everybody, all the film viewers out there, that's just something very special to us.
So you both are film fans, but had either of you actually worked on a movie in any capacity before you did this one?
Yeah, actually, while I was writing this script, I was putting out short scripts to different screenwriting contests, and one of them was aimed at Native American writers, and so they selected a short script that I wrote. It was called Indios Primeros, and it was produced in New Mexico, and they had like a full production, and it was 3 days of shooting, and it was on a large scale.
The first time I was on the set was when Robert was filming. That was the only time I was ever on a set. Been to Universal Studios, That's
not sure that counts.
Yeah, that's the extent of it. It's funny is that beginning of every semester at Arizona State, they sell posters right there at the MU. And some back in the day, they were even selling movie scripts. So I remember buying Pulp Fiction. So
that one Spider-Man script.
I had a Spider-Man script that I bought. I remember reading it, and I go, you know what? I think I could do this. I think I could format a script. And so I've been writing for 20 years. And never have I ever intended to say, you know what, I'm dropping everything going on to L.A.
How do you think that Native American tribal members are portrayed in film generally, to the extent that they are?
Well, it just depends on where you're looking, because if you're going to go to the Hollywood type of movie theater situation, you know, you may not like what you see. But if you see movies like My Brother and Myself, and like, for instance, in Santa Fe right now, they're showing a lot of Native American films by Native American producers and writers and directors and actors taking ownership of their own stories and how they're portrayed. There's a lot of artists, a lot more talented than my brother and I, that are making sure that we have, you know, a piece of this art form as well.
So what's next for you guys? I mean, are you planning to do another movie?
Yeah, we are planning to do, you know, we're planning to take over the world, really. But in the,
that's more of a long-range plan,
yeah,
right?
But in the interim, we have a short film that we are going to produce ourselves along the same lines as we did in Circles. We're just getting our pals, and we're using the equipment that we used before, and we're going to shoot a little short film here on the reservation, and that's just going to be like 3 days. That's just to kind of keep our creative juices flowing. We have a long-term project that features Native Americans very prominently as well, and that's a script that I think came to like the sixth draft. So we want to make that the right way, and we want to let people know that without any funding or without any backing or stars, we were able to commit ourselves and come up with this project called In Circles.
Robert Jackson, along with his brother Claude, is co-director and co-writer of the movie In Circles. There will be a screening of the film on Sunday afternoon at Viquiva Hotel and Casino in Levine. Some of the roads in one Phoenix community were created way before it even was a community. It was a private company that helped pave the area into what it is today. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez takes us there.
The Foothills is a neighborhood in Ahwatukee. It was developed in the 1980s and 90s, and it's surrounded by hills and desert. Did you know the Foothills was originally a testing ground for International Harvester?
They had an operation of about 4,000 acres, and they used it through the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s as a tank proving grounds, informally known as the Phoenix Proving Grounds, formerly known as International Harvester's Phoenix Proving Grounds.
Marty Gibson is an Ahwatukee resident. He's researched and written a book about the community's history.
Harvester had all kinds of equipment, heavy equipment, 18-wheeler trucks, that kind of thing, light trucks, heavy trucks.
Gibson and I are hanging out in the tranquil foothills near 24th Street and Chandler Boulevard. More specifically, we're sitting at the Foothills Golf Clubhouse. This was originally International Harvester's administration and sales building. The surrounding area, including the golf course, was part of the testing grounds. Gibson says General Motors was the first to use this land during World War II. GM tested parts they supplied to the U.S. Army for their tanks. It was considered an ideal site, far away from residential communities, and it had the perfect dry, dusty, hot, and gritty climate.
Conditions mimicked almost ideally the conditions over in South Africa, where the U.S. forces were fighting during World War II. After the war, International Harvester saw it as an ideal location to test and put their heavy equipment and trucks to the test because you have some severe slopes.
International Harvester first leased the land and then purchased it in the late 1960s. The estimated 6.5-mile property went from what we know today as 24th Street to about 17th Avenue, and from the South Mountain foothills to about Pecos Road to the south. It had several testing tracks, including a 7.5-mile paved test track and a 4-mile high-speed track.
When it came time to develop this in the mid-80s, the main roads of the foothills, Chandler Boulevard was extended down in here, Desert Foothills Parkway. They follow exactly the paths of those test tracks.
And near the administration building, now the clubhouse, there was an elevated landing strip that
Harvester constructed to have some of their executives from the Midwest and some of the clients they wanted to wine and dine fly in. All the dirt in that was used to construct every hill, every gully, every angulation on the Foothills Golf Course, which now sits where that strip was.
International Harvester sold the land in the early 1980s, and within several years, two communities were created, the Foothills and the Foothills Club West. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know something that you think we should know, please tell us about it. The show at KJZZ.org. The show is produced by our senior producers Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Annika Klein, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Tracy Greer and Sky Shout are the digital team. Our news director is Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know good story ideas. The show at KJZZ.org. And be sure to download the free KJZZ mobile app to podcast the show on your smartphone. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.